Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay. Hey, hashtag AmWriters. Jess Leahy here. And this is the hashtag AmWriting podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about writing all the things, short things, long things, poetry, proposals, short stories, fiction, nonfiction, doing the research, doing all of it, getting an agent, selling your book. This is really just the podcast where we talk about getting the work done. This week, for those of you who have been listening for any length of time, you know that this guest is very special to my heart. This week we have AJ Jacobs. He is someone that has, I've mentioned in podcasts before, as being a writer that I look up to, not just as a writer, of course I love his writing, but someone that I really look up to as a generous, kind spirit that sort of tells me how I should be with other new writers, because before I had written anything, AJ was really the person who supported me based on a letter I wrote him, an email, I think. So anyway, AJ Jacobs has written a whole bunch of books, My Year of Living Biblically. The first book that he wrote that sort of brought him into the public eye was The Know-It-All, and it was about reading the encyclopedia from A to Z, continuing a project that his father had done. He provided the very first question for my column at the New York Times, the parent-teacher conference. And if I remember correctly, it was a very AJ question. It was, what do I do if I don't think the teacher likes me? This is a classic AJ. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this podcast. His new book, My Year of Living Constitutionally, should be out this week. And I'm so happy to have him on the podcast again. AJ, I am so happy to have you on the show again. I've linked in our show notes to the last time we talked to you. And I feel like, again, for listeners who have not met you yet, I just want to reiterate, and I know it embarrasses you when I do this, but you have been such not only a really good example for me as a writer who's generous to up-and-coming writers, but as I have this constant refrain in my head when people ask me favors, and it's, what would AJ do? And AJ, generally speaking, you're really good at protecting your family time and stuff like that, but you also are incredibly generous to new writers. And I just, anytime someone says, I really appreciate that you're generous to new writers, I'm like, it's because of AJ Jacobs. He told me that's how I'm supposed to do it.
Well, that is huge. I love it. And I love watching you just soar. I mean, you have surpassed me, and I just love it.
Please.
And you know what else I love is getting your emails. Your emails are so funny and well written that I hope someone is collecting them for an anthology or whatever it will be.
I'm a sucker for the letter. I'm a sucker for the letter writing. I think it's going away, and I think that's sad. Like every time I get one of those new, like, here's how you should be doing email. You should cut the salutation. You should cut straight to the point. You should not have any frills in there, and that's how you get through your emails quickly. And I just don't. That's just not how I do it.
Well, thank you for not doing it that way, because it's a joy to read. It's like added value.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
oh, good. So there are
Falcon
certain.
Last time.
Yeah, well, falconry, this was something that I had really, really wanted to do. And not just because I read H's for Hawk, which is a fantastic book. But yeah, we have owls that live behind our house, and we have red-tailed hawks that live behind our house and return to do the same nest every year. This will be year 4 if they come back. And I recently, on a vacation, had the opportunity to actually put on one of those cool gloves with a little piece of raw meat on it and have this hawk fly to my glove. It was so crazy. And the other people, I felt like such a weirdo, because the other people were like, yeah, this is really cool. And I was in full-on, like, 8-year-old mode and just geeking out. I had to really be careful not to talk too much about, like, all the dorky details I know about birds and things like that with the falconry guy. So anyway.
Well, it looked fantastic. The photo was remarkable.
It was really cool. I'll put it in the show notes for those who have no idea what we're talking about. All right. There are a few people that I get really excited when I hear that there is a new book coming out. And I have been fortunate enough to be an early recipient of this new book, AJ Jacobs' new book, it's the year of living constitutionally. And this is, and it's your attempt for 1 year to live, and this is the tricky part, according to the sort of the founder's original intentions, or according to the founder's intentions, which obviously there's a little bit of gray area in there that we have to deal with. But this is the new book coming out in May, and I love it. I'm so happy that this is the most timely book. There's so much to talk about. And, you know, you're not someone who normally goes into politics very often. So I was a little bit surprised, and I wanted to see how far you would take it. And so anyway, we want to get to the guts of this conversation. And the first place I want to start is, since so many of your books are based on experiential type stuff, where do the earliest germ of an idea, where do they come from for you?
Well, I will say I am a big fan of spending 15 minutes a day just brainstorming ideas, like, yes, you know, making an appointment with myself, as they say, and just coming up with ideas. And 98% of them, probably more, are terrible. They are just unusable. And but it really is a numbers game. And I love to do it. Even if I know that they're not going to be usable, I'll just brainstorm about any old thing. It could be article ideas. It could be, I was just saw some snowmen in Central Park. And I thought, you know what? What if there were snow people? What if they were snow non-binary folks? What if they were, instead of a pipe, they were vaping? What about instead of coal for the eyes, they had solar panels? You know, none of this is ever going anywhere, and it's all pretty useless. But it just gets my brain into the habit of being flexible and creative, and I love that. So that is one tip I have. For this book, go ahead.
Can I ask one quick question about that? So what I found is that as a writer, often I'm brainstorming with myself, which is a little, for me anyway, feels a little bit weird. So it's really important for me occasionally to brainstorm with other people. Do you have someone else that you kind of say, like, is this a thing? Is this snowman book a thing? Is that?
It is not. But I definitely, I guess one way to think about this is, how do you separate the 98% crap from the 2% that are hopefully gems? Mm-hmm. And I have a couple of methods. One is, if I keep coming back to it in my mind for weeks later, months later. Another is, I'm a really big fan of focus grouping, you know, just talking about ideas. And you can't always trust your friends because they're sometimes too nice to you, but you can see their eyes light up, or especially if they start brainstorming along with you and they're like, oh my God, what if you had a pussy hat instead of a top hat? And so it is, those are some of the ways that it resonates, that I decide what is worth pursuing.
Cool. Okay, cool. So you had a second part to your answer that you were giving me about have the 15-minute talk with yourself every day, have that generative 15 minutes. And what else were you going to add to that? You had a next thing that I interrupted you.
Oh, well, I mean, I also think the ideas come from all over the place. I mean, my first book was about reading the encyclopedia, and that came from my life. My father, when I was a kid, started to read the encyclopedia. But he didn't finish. He only made it to the middle of the letter B around boomerang. And I was like, well, that's interesting. What if I finished what he began and wrote a book about that? So another method I use a lot is taking an idea and just pushing it to its extreme. It's almost absurd extreme. Not almost, totally absurd extreme. I wrote an article a long, long time ago called My Outsourced Life. This was when outsourcing was just...
I remember that. That was great. You had a virtual assistant for so many things, and it was very funny.
I did. I had a team, not just one. I had a team of people in Bangalore who would respond to emails for me, but also argue with my wife for me and read bedtime stories to my son. So that's another way of doing it. And sometimes this book, the new one about the year of living constitutionally, I actually had probably 15 years ago, but I never really pursued it because it didn't seem that the time was quite right. And I got this idea as a sort of a spinoff to the year of living biblically, which was a book where I tried to follow all the rules of the Bible as literally as possible. And I always thought, well, the Constitution, we kind of treat that as our country's Bible. We treat it in the same way as like a sacred text. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a way to replicate that journey, but with the Constitution. So that had always been cooking and simmering in the back of my mind. And then came this swing to originalism with the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. the Dobbs opinion, all of these incredibly consequential happenings around the Constitution and how to interpret it. And I'm like, you know what? It's time. Oh, and the last thing I'll say, I hope I'm not rambling.
No, of course not.
I am a little. But I also am a fan of sort of test driving in smaller ways. So this actually, I kind of floated a trial balloon by writing an article about it in The Guardian before I started a book. I wanted to see, is there enough here for a book? And if I spent like 2 weeks trying it and write an article, that's a good way to test it.
Do you run stuff by your agent or early, or is that something you don't do until you're ready to actually write a proposal?
I do. And in fact, this book, I had lunch with my editor, who was fantastic, and I came to lunch prepared with 5 book ideas, and this was one of them. Yeah, thank you. I try to be prepared. Like with this podcast, I wrote my notes.
You did.
And one of them was about kindness and helping others. And she said, no one cares about kindness, which was sad.
Well done. Yes. Nice.
She didn't really mean that. She just meant it's hard to sell a book about kindness.
Yeah.
But this one, she said, well, this feels very topical, very timely. Mm-hmm. And for better or worse, what's selling now is very topical, timely things. I've had my agent and people tell me, I loved the book, like the history of salt, how salt changed the world. How cod changed the world. Yeah. All of these bands.
Give me something obscure and 300 pages about it, and I am in.
I am in too.
Yeah,
but apparently editors and the public are not as in. That is a hard sell right now. Now, what editors are looking for is really the timely, newsy, what has an impact on people right now.
We actually interviewed someone a while back, and she talked about the fact that she does this with her agent. Yeah, with her agent, where she'll, you know, throw out a list of things. And I loved that because it does acknowledge that we are having to try to sell to a market. So, like, we have to be a little bit less precious about our ideas, that some of them are going to sell. You could write an entire book about, you know, I had Jenny Lawson, who writes these wonderful books.
Oh, sure. I love her.
She's hysterical. Right. So she posted to social media that she had a dream about this. You know, she'd answered this massive question in her dream, and it turned out to be nothing. I dreamed that I wrote an entire book on the history of the linchpin.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, but I would read that. But you
I
know,
would
that's,
too. I mean, how did it become the metaphor
exactly
for the most important changes in history?
My dream self came up with that. Well, my editor probably wouldn't be in, but I love the fact that you're willing to say, here are some ideas that I'm invested enough to actually write down on paper. And I'm cool with the fact that you're going to say these will go nowhere, because I think for a lot of people, you just want to appear to be super smart all the time and be dialed into what the market wants and be, and not ever have a misfire. But I think it's really important to have the misfires, because who knows, those things that are the misfires may end up being something later, whether in terms of an article or an idea for something else.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, the failure is very important, and always keep those ideas. But yes, I am a big fan of not writing an entire proposal until I've got some buy-in from either my agent or my editor.
I'm in the process of writing a proposal right now, and I'm doing the chapter summaries first because that's what my agent likes to see first. So rather than going into the whole other like market analysis and all that stuff, doing the chapter summaries first. And I used to hate that process. I really like it now because it forces me to crystallize these ideas and figure out like, oh no, that doesn't work at all. This is not even a thing. That could be like a paragraph in a chapter, but it's not necessarily a whole chapter.
Right.
Is there a part? Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm actually a huge fan of trying to come up with a structure very early in the process, maybe even before deciding to write the book, because that I need structure. I am one of those people who needs it. And my books have a very set structure. And within that structure, of course, you can be completely creative. That old saying that structure leads to creativity. I fully buy it. So, for instance, I wrote a book about health and I didn't know it's such a huge topic. Where do I start? And I only cracked it when I said, OK, what if I did it by body part? I'll have a chapter on the stomach, a chapter on lungs, a chapter on the butt. And I missed the greatest pun opportunity because I didn't have an appendix. I should have had an appendix.
Oh, man.
So, yeah.
Lost opportunity there.
Huge lost opportunity.
Yeah. Speaking of which, while we're on that topic, does your dad still hold the record for having the most footnotes in a legal article still? Is that still holding
Thank
for him?
You for remembering. Yes.
Yes.
He has the record of 4,824 footnotes in a law review article, which is three times the number of anyone else. And the article is hilarious because it's like three lines of text and the rest is footnotes. Weirdly, I was just talking to a friend of mine last night who told me my next book, I should try to beat that record. I don't actually think that is a great book, but I love the idea nonetheless.
I don't think there are as many people who love footnotes as much as I do, but I realize that in the world of hyperlinks, you know, when you're writing something online, I would make every word a hyperlink to something because that's sort of like footnotes. Like it's kind of playful and fun when you can link to something silly, but it's still part of the conversation. And so I love using links in my articles. I mean, you know, my editors don't always love it as much as I do, but I love it. And it's really fun. It reminds me of footnotes.
I am a big fan. My new book has a bunch of footnotes because sometimes there's just such a great fact that I want to include, but it would interrupt the flow. But I just want to give the reader the nugget.
Yeah.
Like when I was talking about the Declaration of Independence and the signing and John Hancock, I read a very interesting defense that he did not sign too big. I always thought he was kind of like, you know, flexing.
Yeah.
But it turns out there was so much room at the bottom. It was everyone else signed too small. So
yeah, interesting.
That was important for the reader to know. But
it was
not
an aesthetic choice.
Enough. It was an aesthetic.
I like that.
Maybe.
I like it.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Anyway, so we were talking about the organization because most people, I think when you hear the year of, you're like, okay, January, February, March. And, you know, certain books do... you know, like Barbara Kingsolver's book about her gardening and all that sort of stuff. And it just went away in my head. The title just went away, but I'll put it in the show notes. You know, that makes sense because you're like, okay, you start with February, the hungry month, and then you go through the, you know, the year of gardening. But you don't do that. And so, but I think that it's really tempting to go by, you know, months or go by amendment or go by, you know, book of the Bible. So how do you... Is there one that just sort of comes to you and then it sort of makes sense and you go, oh yeah, that's the organizing mode for this book?
Well, I think all my books are chronological, but I don't just do the chronology because I don't think it's enough of a structure. So for this one, I said, yeah, I am going to do it mostly by theme, by First Amendment, there's a chapter on Second Amendment, there's mm-hmm. a chapter on muskets, Third Amendment, there's a chapter on quartering soldiers. But on top of that, so that's one layer. You have to figure out what will be enough that it will constitute, no pun intended, a great chapter. And then on top of that, you also have to have a bigger structure for the book. You have to have some sort of arc. And sometimes that happens in my life. My first book coincided with my wife and I having trouble. She was having trouble getting pregnant. And so it was all about the quest for that. This book had one. It was not really my life. This one instead, the book started in the fall and it started in November around election time. And I decided one 18th century custom that is worth reviving is the election cake. They used to make these huge election cakes and bring them to, and elections were more festive for the very small privileged group that could vote. So we got to get rid of that idea.
Well, I like the idea of having an election cake that, like, whoever, it's like the queen's cake, whoever gets the baby in the cake is the one who gets elected president. There you go. That's how we decide our presidency from here on out. That's going to be it.
That is a very interesting idea. I had not explored that, but thank you for that. This is more just a celebration of, we should be thankful that we have democracy. And remind ourselves that democracy is sweet. So I started with making a one little election cake, and I decided, well, what if at the end of the year I got people in every state of America to make an election cake, and I put it on social media, and it just took off, and people were so creative, and they made cakes based on their state. Like, you know, there was a Hawaiian cake that had a lei, and it was fantastic. So that I thought was, all right, there's a little through line. It's not the only through line, but it's something I can keep coming back to. And it ends on a positive note, because there's so much terrible news. There's so much that makes you just want to curl up in the fetal position. And I don't want that. I want people to be energized and get out there and actually try to save our democracy. So that was, I was like, this will be a nice, fun arc.
Well, and also, I, as a big fan of the why, you know, there's, you know, getting at why we do some of the crazy wacko things that we do in our electoral process, you know, it helps to understand, you know, why those things arose. And I, frankly, would love a book with tons and tons of footnotes on all the factoids that, you know, you just find enchanting, like the cake thing. Yeah. There was, I think in some of my research around alcohol in the United States, I seem to remember that George Washington bought a lot of beer for people who voted.
Mm. Not just beer, rum. Yeah. You know, and yes, it was, they got him drunk. And I decided to focus on the cake instead of the rum punch, so to make it a little more accessible to
That makes sense.
Everyone. But yes, they were very much, I mean, it was a day drinking world back then. They definitely.
They had beer recipes for kids too. They had these things called, they had like a cock ale that you would put like eggs and meat into the beer and mix it all up. And then you'd give that to your kid for breakfast.
Oh my goodness. So yeah. Good,
yeah. Yeah. So a question. So you get these ideas, some stick, some don't. And then as you're trying to figure out how to move forward, like how do you get to the place where you're like, okay, this constitutional book is going to happen. Now what do you do? Because our listeners and I adore that research process. So where do you start when you're like, okay, here we go. The year of living constitutionally. I got to go read some stuff.
I did. And I love this process. I mean, I will tell you, I love 2/3 of being a writer. I love the research.
Mm-hmm.
I love the talking about it like now with you. I hate the writing. I hate as many of your listeners.
Because it's hard. It's hard, AJ.
You're alone. Yeah. It is not fun. But anyway, I love the research. I love, I go out and I just, You know, I'll actually go to a physical bookstore and buy a bunch of books. I will talk to as many people as I can and interview them and follow different strange rabbit holes, but always with an eye to developing themes. I don't just do it randomly. I'm like, all right, well, there's a lot here about, there's a lot here about old laws against speech, how you couldn't, how there were blasphemy laws and there were laws against cursing. If you cursed in New York in 1801, you had to pay 37.5 cents to the government. So I'm like, all right, this goes in the First Amendment section, and I'll actually have a folder in my computer, First Amendment. Then I'll, I'll read some other book, or I'll talk to some other person, and they're talking about, how the president has become so much more powerful than he was in founding times. So let's have a folder on how the president has become a monarch. And so you're always building these different themes. And by the end, I had like 30 themes. 10 of them I dropped. That's another thing. A lot of the adventures I go on and interviews, I don't end up in the book. And I feel terrible for the people I interviewed. I actually, this time, economically, this was not a great book because I sent quill pens to a bunch of the people I interviewed because I wanted to thank them and also apologize that they informed the book, but they didn't make it in.
That's very, very cool.
So that's one thing.
So granular, we're going deep here. Are you an index card note taker guy? Are you a post-it flag, like a little sticky tab kind of guy? Are you a write notes on the computer, write notes by hand? How do you sort of make sure that things that are in the books that you really want to retain for later use, that they don't get lost?
Great question. And I'm not saying I recommend this because it may not be the most efficient, but it does work for me. I have folders in my computer. For all of the potential chapters. So I'm looking down. I have one on the 19th Amendment, the voting. There's one on petitions, one on pirates and privateers. And then I go in and I have one Word document, which I know is old style, where I just take notes either from books or from brainstorming or conversations or interviews. And that goes into that file. And then after I have built up enough, then I try to look at all of the notes and clump them into different themes and try to shape the chapter. And then I write the chapter from that. I also have a Word document called Constitution Before Closing. And it's like 150 pages because it's always things like, you know, don't forget to mention this, or don't forget to credit this person, or don't forget that, I'm just looking at it right now. Plagiarism check. That's always in there.
I have a document called Orphans where it's like the stuff I cut that, not just the normal stuff I cut, but like the stuff I cut and I'm like, ooh, that hurts. I really want to try to use that somewhere. So I just stick it all on a thing called Orphans.
I love that. I'm going to do that. Because also you can use that for articles when the book comes out. There's a use for it. There will be a use for it.
So just for fun, my thing lately has been I take a book and then I have these sticky tabs that come in like lots of colors. It's a little booklet and it's got like 12 colors in it. And I pick three. And one color is for quotes, one color is for like a big idea, and one color is for come back to this and check it out. So while I'm reading the book, I underline things and jot notes in the margins. And at the same time, shush, Henry. And at the same time, I stick the appropriate color post-it note in. So I have all of my books are just jammed. And then what's really funny is you say you sort of have themes. So if I were to turn my computer slightly, you might be able to see that there is a bookshelf right there with post-it notes, but underneath sort of areas of books. So those usually end up being chapters for me. So for example, if let's say all those books are about avocados, I would have like history of the avocado, books about history of the avocado, books about, you know, cuisine with the avocado. And then those piles become very, very important to me because that's sort of like the research backlog, and obviously articles go in there too. But like when we moved to this house, I was in the middle of writing the addiction inoculation and I boxed my books according to chapter because that's, and my articles. So I had like a box that said like education and a box that said, you know, genetics or whatever. So yeah.
How do you go from the post-it notes and underlining to writing the chapter? Is there an intermediate?
Yeah. So post-it notes is sort of first read through. And then I go back to like the big ideas or to the quotes. And I have a pretty good memory for where things are when I first read them. And then I go through and I just type those notes into the computer because I'm probably going to end up quoting anyway. My biggest fear. Oh, here's a question for you. How do you prevent yourself from plagiarizing? Like, how do you put any notation next to a line that you maybe wrote that was in a book to remind you that that's a quote and that you shouldn't just write what you wrote because that wasn't you, that was someone else?
Oh, yeah. And I'm terrified that I would never intentionally plagiarize,
right?
But I'm terrified I might unintentionally plagiarize. Right. So I do two things. One, I do put quotes in a separate color. So quotes are in red.
Good.
And the second thing I do is I think it was Grammarly. I ran this chapter by chapter through a plagiarism checking software, and nothing came up. Thankfully.
That is so smart because I live in fear of, oh, I forgot those quotation marks. In my notes, I just put a big Q at the beginning, but color would be even better. But then I'd be afraid that I forgot to change the color or something. So I love the idea of running it through Grammarly. That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Basically, there's just so much. I mean, the thing is, there's between articles and the stuff that you read comes in lots of forms, like digital, and then you got paper everywhere. And it's a lot to organize. And I'm fascinated by how people organize their research.
Yeah. And I also like to give in the acknowledgments and the credits. I'm definitely big on giving shout outs to people. If I didn't quote them, but I sort of, they inspired me.
Right. The genesis for this idea came from blah, blah, blah at a dinner party, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I love that.
Exactly.
Okay, so you have your shape of your book, you have your research, and then you do a lot of talking to people, as you mentioned, the people you give the quill pens to and stuff like that. How do you go about figuring out who it is you want to talk to in person? And I'm so worried that I'm going to waste people's time and then not use their stuff, and you know, people are busy. So how do you decide who it is you want to talk to in an interview?
I'm always looking for good characters. Mm-hmm. So a person could be the expert in, in the Fourth Amendment. But if they don't have a good background or a good story, then I might quote them, but I might not feature them.
Right.
And this book, actually, CBS Sunday Morning followed me around on many of my adventures. And the producer was always like, what's going to make a good scene? What's going to make a good scene? And some of that seeped in because I do think, you know, we're visual thinkers. So,
yeah.
So what would make a good set piece? Like, you know, I dressed up in my tricorn hat and my musket and went to the Battle of Monmouth and I died for our country in this Revolutionary War. I did die in the shade. So it wasn't so bad.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was relaxed. But it's like, all right, well, this is a nice set piece. This will be good. So that's one thing. One when I'm interviewing people, and this, not everyone does this or even would approve of this, but I'm just going to tell you my process is when I start an interview, I say, I hope to quote you. You know, I may not, but I hope to. If I do quote you, I will send you your quotes to make sure I got them right. Now, as a journalist, I was taught not to do this. This is bad. But I find it good for several reasons. First, like, I'm not out to do gotcha journalism. I'm out to, like, make an interesting book. And a lot of times, the people, I'll send them the quote and they'll improve it. They won't censor
it. Oh, interesting.
They'll say, oh, actually, women could vote in New Jersey in 1800. So you might want to add that to the quote. And it, so I found it to be helpful. And it's just from a stress point of view, it's my book is not going to come out. And people are like, I never said that.
Yeah.
So and I also, the benefit is when I say that, I feel it frees people up. They are much looser. They're much more willing to play along and go down weird rabbit holes because they know I'm not out to make him look like an idiot. I'm out to make myself look like an idiot. That's usually what I do. But I'm not out to make them look like an idiot.
With the addiction inoculation, because that stuff was so personal and it was so, I don't know. I just want to make sure I got it all right. So everything in that book pretty much went back to the original source and they got to read all that stuff. And you're right. I think a lot of people were like, oh, and add this or, and you know, there were some people who were like, you know, I just don't like the shading of this. But the other interesting thing about it is that here's one thing that scares me to death is I guess this is a good thing that people will go ahead and tell me things that they don't want in there. They'll say things like, you know, well, this is off the record, but da 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 da. And I have yet to come up with the perfect solution to my fear that I'm going to put something in there that was off the record or too personal. And they sort of, because there's a lot of switching back and forth between things that are off the record and things that are on the record, especially when you develop a relationship with someone and you're not strictly just a journalist, you know, that kind of thing. So I've had to come up with big, like, draw big circles around this. This is not for popular consumption kind of thing. But I'm very, very worried about that. And that gets rid of that. If I say, you know, this is something that I'm going to send back to you and we can tweak it if you're worried about the tone or anything, then there'll be a lot more forthcoming, I think.
That's what I find. It's very helpful.
Well, the other thing that I think that's so lovely about your writing is that occasionally people do stuff that's really weird and funny, but you never, ever mock people. You never, ever go to someone who chews a blueberry 36 times before swallowing it and ever come off as derisive or anything other than, oh, that's interesting. And I think the fact that you're curious will get people to share things with you that they might not otherwise because they know, oh, this could be portrayed as a little bit weird.
I love that you say that. That is very high praise. Thank you. And yes, I think curiosity and not going in with an axe to grind makes for a better book. It makes for I do that. And another, when I'm interviewing someone or when I'm writing a chapter, one sort of North Star I always have is why is this important? Why would the reader care about this? How does it affect their life? So I love the weird stuff and I could do a whole book on footnotes, but I know I'm a bit of an outlier. So I always remind. So for instance, I'll give you one for instance. The book is about me trying to follow the Constitution as literally as possible, like the ultimate originalist. And the Constitution in Section 1, Article 1, Section 8 says Congress can grant you a letter of mark and reprisal, which means you can become a pirate. Like the government has the ability to say, you're a pirate. You can take your fishing boat and go attack the enemy ships and keep the booty. You can keep whatever's in there, the booze, the wine, the uniforms. This has not been used since 1815. But it's still on the books. It's still in the Constitution. So I actually set up a meeting with a congressman and I applied to become a pirate or a privateer is the preferred term.
Yeah.
And it was a funny scene, but it was just that. It was a funny scene. Why is it important? Why should I include it except as sort of a commentary on that there are some archaic things in the Constitution? And so what I thought, I gave it enough thought that I was able to come up with an anchor that I think makes it more important, that resonates at least with me, which is these privateers, these pirates, we would not have a country without them. They, during the revolution, they captured 2,000 British ships, and no one talks about them because they're kind of embarrassing. It's like that our country was founded on these sort of sleazy-ish pirates who were in it partly for the money. But at the same time, it's a reminder that our country's birth was not an immaculate conception. It was ugly. There was a lot of unpleasant stuff. But we should acknowledge that, and we should also continue to reach for the ideals, because some of these privateers actually were patriotic and did think it was terrible that we had a monarch. So the bigger point of the chapter was even something that had an ugly origin, maybe we can still rescue it and still strive for a greater, more just country. But we shouldn't whitewash the fact that it was a very complicated birth. So that's something that I always keep in mind. How can I make a bigger point? And so that it's not just these fun, random facts.
I love that. But if Aaron Sorkin can write an entire episode of The West Wing about privateers, and then I think it could fit in your book.
I didn't know that. I'm going to have to check that out.
It's, in fact, I think it's called Privateers, and it is one of the funniest episodes I think there is. And it's basically that the First Lady's family is in the Daughters of the American Revolution or something, but her family are privateers and she was going to be honored at something. And this very stodgy woman is very upset by that. And she's going to boycott the thing because Abigail's relatives were privateers. Yeah. Pirates, as she puts it. So it's a very, very funny episode. I'll send you the link, the number
I'll
of the episode. Yeah.
Track
really, really good. I have, and when it comes to the extra stuff that maybe should be cut, I flash to previous things I've written and my editors having in the margins jargon or nobody cares or could we just cut this? I don't think the normal person will care quite as much as you do about this rando fact that may be entertaining but maybe doesn't fit. But wherever I can get the rando facts to attach to something larger, then I get to save my rando fact that I love and make a larger point. So, yeah.
I also find it very helpful to try to get into the beginner's mind and try to get into the mind of the reader. So I will put a chapter away for a week. And then before reading it, I will read something totally unrelated, a book about falconry, perhaps. So my mind is in a totally different space. And then I will act as if I'm a reader. I'm really trying to method act, what's this book about? And then I pick it up and I'm like, well, this is so inside baseball. I don't really care. And that I find very helpful, having this sort of grapefruit sorbet for your brain before reading it, the chapter again, and trying to act as if you are a reader totally unfamiliar.
I like that. My friends and I, we also refer to some books, and I am not going to say who wrote them, as books where the editor was afraid of or intimidated by the writer. And so the editor was afraid to speak up. So too much made it into the book. And we refer to those as the books where they just really needed an editor. And I like putting myself in the hands of a capable editor. And I've been lucky to have those. So every time I'm like, oh, yeah, is this inside baseball? Is this too much? Is this something that my friend would deride as, needing to have been cut in the first place.
I love my editor, but I also send the book as early as possible to 20 friends who are very generous. And I have very specific instructions. I say, tell me the 20 parts, tell me the 5 parts you love the most and the 5 parts that made your eyes glaze over.
That's smart.
It really is so helpful because If you just send it to one person, that's fine, but that person might be an outlier. But 20 people, like if I have 12 people say, this chapter kind of made my eyes glaze over. If enough people say that, then you're like, oh, something's wrong. I've either got to fix this chapter or cut it. So yeah, then that is another good way to avoid the jargon and the inside baseball problem.
So how do you, since you said very specifically that you don't love the writing process, how do you, you know, move away from the parts that are just your favorite? I mean, I would just research books and never write them all day long. I love that. How do you get your butt in the chair so that you can actually get the words on paper?
Well, this one had the toughest deadline of my career. And I'm old, so I've had a lot of deadlines.
But like
this
it was one, short?
Super short. It was a year of living constitutionally. It was literally a year of writing and living and fact-checking and researching the Constitution. And usually I have 2 years. I have twice as much time. But the publisher, I think rightly, thought that this is a very timely topic. They wanted it out well before the election, so give people some space. So I was freaking out. I am a visual person, so I actually printed out pages from a calendar. So on my wall, I had March, April, May, June, July. And I said, all right, I've got to start writing. I've got to write the intro by April 4th. And then I've got to, you know, and I actually, thank you to Ben Franklin, my favorite founding father, who had a very strict schedule that he writes about. He gets up at 5 a.m. He doesn't get enough sleep. That's not healthy. He went to bed at like midnight or 1. But I went to bed at like 10, and I would wake up at 5, and I would write nonstop until noon, if possible, if I didn't have anything else. And I gave myself word counts. I have to write at least 1,000 today. And that was extremely helpful. And it was hard, though.
Were you sending off chapters sequentially as you finished them to your editor, or did you sort of hold on to everything until the end?
No, it's interesting. My first few books, I had a different editor who only wanted to see it at the end. Mm-hmm. My current editor does like me to send chunks. I don't send just one chapter. Mm-hmm. Well, I did send the intro, but then I send like 2 or 3 or 4 chapters. I like that. I like what is your method? What do you do?
My first book, I made the mistake of sending all off at once. And it turns out my editor and I were on completely different pages, so to speak. And so the book required an entire rewrite. However, with the addiction inoculation, I sent it off in chunks to make sure that we were in the same place and in the same headspace. And I was doing what she was excited about, and it worked spectacularly well. And if I can do that again, I think that was at least at the beginning, sending some off. Yes, you've written a sample chapter for the proposal, but at least when you send some off, you can at least know if you're in a mind meld with your editor, or at least close to a mind meld. Yeah. So I think I've done it both ways. And I think I prefer the sending it off in chunks. Best.
I do too. I do. And yeah. What about having friends read it? Do you?
No one reads my stuff until my agent reads first. Always, she's a fantastic editor. In fact, she used to work for my previous editor as an editorial assistant, so she knew exactly what she liked. So she reads everything first, and then it goes to my editor. But no, when Tim's in both of my books, especially Addiction Inoculation, and he. And a lot of it was about, you know, what I did as an alcoholic. And a lot of that was new information to him. And he found out in reading The Galley.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. And yeah. Does he have veto power over anything?
Yeah. At that point, he still had veto power. He's never asked me to change anything, though. He did ask me to he asked me to change something I said in a talk once, just because he thought it made him look like a super dork. But yeah, no. Julie has veto power.
She does. She hasn't vetoed much. When I wrote a book about the Bible, she asked me to pare down the sections about her menstrual cycle, which is probably good. Like, you know, the Bible has a lot of rules about menstruation. Mm. And And she was right. I don't think the readers needed to know that much detail. So
maybe the readers want to like sync up with Julie so they can really feel like they're a part of the reading. So
maybe. Yeah. But in general, no, she doesn't.
So just to close up, since we've gone way over, but I don't care because talking to you is so much fun. So when you have your finished book and you are ready for that sort of to all come together, did you have your title from the very beginning? And then do you have a big fight over subtitles, or is that sort of set from the beginning?
Well, it depends on the book. This book, since my best known book is called The Year of Living,
Year of Living Biblically. Yeah.
I pitched this as The Year of Living Constitutionally, and my editor had some qualms. She said, is it too close? And I said, yes, but I think that's I think that's a good thing. And she was like, okay, let's do it. And then the subtitle came pretty quickly too. But I had
25 subtitles for The Gift of Failure, and that we actually have fought about subtitles more than I think anything else.
You know, like, what is the end subtitle? How did it go?
The end subtitle was The Gift of Failure: How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. The problem is that, like, often for the addiction inoculation, I think our problem was is we kept repeating the word addiction in the subtitle. And anyway, there's an example of too much inside baseball. No one cares about our subtitles.
I disagree.
Oh, here's a fun question though. As someone who's been writing a lot longer than I have, when can I get rid of the boxes in my basement of all my research for my first book?
That is a good question. I don't think
like all the articles there. I have boxes of my.
I say, I donate it to a college. I would like to see the Jess Leahy archives. I am ready, but I am not good at that. I do chuck things out. So yeah,
we have a wood stove, and I need things to start it with. So that's how that goes.
I mean, this
paper
book
to start that.
This book was interesting because I did write a lot of it with a quill pen. I did write. So I actually do have a lot of paper and parchment. I have actual parchment, and I've got like cotton rag paper. So there was a bit of that, which actually, like when I was looking at your logo, I was like, hey, there's the feather. I didn't use a chicken feather. I used the goose quill. The goose quill was what they used. Or the swan, which is
that logo, that little chicken thing for the Am Writing podcast came from my first book that never got published, which was called The Education of a Flatlander. And it was about learning how to garden and keep chickens and do all those things up in New Hampshire. And that was originally for that book, but we just liked it. So we kept it for the podcast.
It is great. I knew you were a chicken. I didn't know you had written about it, though. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, it was awful. That's why you don't know about it, because it was my first book, and it was learning how to write a book, and I sold off pieces of it as magazine articles. So, like, there's a magazine article out there about the time I had a dream about crocheting little comb hats for my rooster because was getting frostbite on his comb. When it's really cold outside, what do they do with their little combs? They get frostbitten. So anyway, so those articles are out there in regional magazines and stuff like that. But the book should never see the light of day. It was awful. So anyway. So your book comes out in May. We're gonna put a link to order in the show notes. And I'm so delighted by your work. It's sort of when there are people that I aspire to, you know, I love the experiential thing. I love, you know, between you and Bill Bryson and other people that just go out in the world and do stuff and try stuff. Like, that to me is the epitome of being a lifelong learner. And I'm so happy to have you out there telling me about the stuff that I don't have time to read about so that I can learn even more about it.
Thank you, Jess. And right back at you. I love your work, and I love that you are a fully curious person in the best way.
Well, and I'm very glad that I've never had to stone anyone in any of my books. AJ had to stone someone in The Year of Living Biblically.
But with small stones, like pebbles.
Very small pebbles.
No one was hurt.
Small pebbles.
And I didn't shoot anyone with a musket, although I did go to a musket range and shoot.
I went to Ticonderoga twice this year and thought about you each time I was there because I knew what you were working on. And the whole time I was at Ticonderoga, I'm like, is there anything I should tell AJ about while I'm here?
Well, next time I'll see you there.
All right. So for anyone who has more questions for AJ or questions for me, for that matter, about the process of researching, we've been putting out these weekly questions for the people who get our Substack, and we get all kinds of cool suggestions about different ways to do things. So if I come across anything when I put out the question, how do you do your research? How do you move from the research to the writing? I'll let you know if anything really
I would love
up.
To answer. Yeah. I love talking about this stuff. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you so much, AJ. And The Year of Living Constitutionally again comes out in May. And definitely pre-order it because, as you know, as we tell you all the time, pre-orders matter to us authors. Exactly. So please pre-order.
Huzzah.
Huzzah. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause, stop.
Thank you.